The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
It's another Wednesday. That means another Mission Minded. It runs right here exclusively on Tony Curry Radio at noon and 7 every Wednesday. Mission Minded is a mind of your mission, your mind. And it's Michael Coleman, of course, the executive director of the Jimmy Hale Mission. We talked about a lot of non-for-profits and entrepreneurial footprints in the business world. We'll talk about that last week. Of course, we got into the Peloton situation. Hardly a business on collapse. It was worth $50 billion 3 weeks ago, now worth about a third of that. But Michael had some great insight into that and what exactly happened with that company. He joins us right now on Tony Curry Radio. And Michael, you're now up on Spotify. You've hit the big time, man. So anytime people want to go see or hear any of the Mission Minded shows, they go to Spotify. You can search Tony Curry Radio or Mission Minded and listen to any of the back archived issues we've had of Mission Minded now. But it's about 4 or 5 weeks in. How you doing, brother? What's going on?
I'm doing great. Just excited to get into this and talk about, as I was doing some research on this and talking about looking at companies who have suffered from lack of strategic vision and get caught up in just only the tactical, the day-to-day. We just have major company after major company. But the beauty of this is, while we have so many well-known major corporations, it's just as applicable for a little small business mom and pop shop or the nonprofit that one is working in or leading or thinking about starting. So the things that we're talking about are applicable across so many fronts. And so just excited to jump into it today.
Listen, as a business owner, and certainly you've owned your share of businesses and you'll run a very successful one in the Jimmy Hale Mission as well. You know, we'd all like to explode, right? We all like to sit down. I think the nightmare scenario, and I've seen commercials where a guy goes online and he sits there and waits to see the numbers start clicking up and they go to 50 or 60,000 within 10 minutes. You're like, okay, what do I do now? That kind of happened with Peloton. I mean, it blew up. They knew what to expect, I think, to an extent, but then they overbought, they overshot. Now they've got warehouses full of their bicycles and all their treadmills and everything they do from a fitness standpoint. And now they're trying to get rid of those things. And by dropping the price, it certainly doesn't look good to the consumer. But it's also, I guess, a good problem to have. But you also mentioned several others. And again, I want to get into the strategic and tactical planning of it because you really kind of crystallize exactly what that means and why that happens. But you mentioned Kodak, you mentioned Blockbuster, which at one point was just, I mean, I remember the owner of Blockbuster, he had his Blockbuster boat outside Fort Lauderdale. And I believe there's still one Blockbuster open. I think it's in San Diego. Life is cyclical. It's coming back around. I heard the other day that cassette tapes are up over 120% over 2021. I'm like, okay, they've been telling me about vinyl for 50 years. Yeah. Like, hold on to your vinyl, hold on to your baseball cards. And I guess eventually all things come back around, but now all of a sudden cassette tapes are hot again. And actually some producers and some famous celebrities, including Taylor Swift, are now coming out with cassette tapes. But you talk about Circuit City. You mentioned some names where I just totally forgot that they were even a company at one point in time. Right. And then the one that's near and dear to my heart that obviously was at the pinnacle of their business was Tower Records.
Yeah.
That just fell apart because they didn't adapt to the changes in their business world and they didn't have strong strategic or tactical planning. So I want you to kind of go one by one just with some of these companies, because I know you've done your homework, but talk about just briefly what happened to each, say Kodak, for example. I mean, obviously the visual business, and now we have cameras in our phones left and right. Who would have thunk it 5-10 years ago?
Yeah, it's so funny because I think back to, you know, some of these were just the core of everybody who knew who Kodak was.
Yep.
And it was everything. But what you'll see a lot when you're talking about strategic plans, you're looking at really big picture. Identify a big goal, like something that's just you couldn't imagine in a million years you'd be able to accomplish. And then what happens is, you know, that leads you to, well, how do we get there? Do we need to innovate? We anticipate? You're looking at so many different factors. But what happens is it's so easy, like Peloton, when you begin to be successful, you're like, hey, we're in a groove. It's always going to be like this. Everybody puts their guard down. We're ahead of the industry and whatever it is, or we're controlling the industry. So now it becomes about, hey, let's just keep producing this and producing this. But nothing, especially when it comes to technology, it ever stays the same. And so all it takes is for you to take your eye off the goal and just say, hey, we're just going to keep replicating this every day. And you're going to look up and there's companies that have left you behind. And in these particular companies' cases, it happened to where they got left behind to the point that they had to file for bankruptcy. So if you look at Kodak, and as I did a little bit of research on this, and some really interesting things that I think a lot of our listeners would be surprised about. Kodak back in 1975 was actually the first company to develop a consumer digital camera. And that was all the way back in 1975. And of course, I don't remember hearing anything about digital almost before 2000, you know, but in the late 1990s, I guess, is when we had computers, people were getting used to having desktops at home. You start talking about digital things. But, you know, some 20 to 25 years before that, Kodak developed the first digital camera, but they couldn't get it approved or they couldn't launch it. And the reason was because there was a fear that if they begin to sell this, it would impact their film market. So they couldn't, they're like, if we start to sell, yeah, it's a really neat idea. It's kind of a toy or whatever, but what they didn't want to introduce almost like something that would compete or change the dynamic with who they were. And so they sidelined it for many, many, many years and just continued to. So instead of thinking strategically, like, okay, what can we do digitally? Where can this go? How does this fit our bigger picture of maintaining market dominance? They said, no, this will interfere, this innovation. And so they didn't want to take any risk. I keep coming back to risk because so often tactical leaders just deal with the issues in front of them. They can't see strategic. They can't see down the road. And so their decisions are governed by the now of what are the risks, what are the fears, and it paralyzes them. And that's exactly what happened to Kodak. So what happened was they completely missed the digital revolution after they actually were the ones who began, who started it off back in 1975. And so Kodak filed for bankruptcy in 2012. And, you know, I called a lot of people by surprise that such an incredibly large company and so dominant for so many years now was really struggling I don't think they'll ever recapture the market share that they had or even come close to it.
That's amazing too, because I mean, Kodak was a brand name from the standpoint, like we say tissues, we call them Kleenex. We don't even call them tissues. Exactly. And when you had a camera, you called it a Kodak, whether it was a Kodak or not. What's amazing about what you're telling me here is, they only had a brilliant idea with Kodak, its inception, but they had a second brilliant idea, but they were afraid. We always talk about flanking your businesses. You know, you put a business out just to take a market share from another business. You don't expect to win that fight, but you do it just to pull something away. They actually flanked themselves, but they never pulled the trigger on it, did they?
That's right. I mean, they had the technology. If they would have just been thinking differently, if they'd been shaped to say, okay, and sometimes it's very difficult to see in the future. I don't know that anybody could see. I mean, you hear things like Steve Jobs where, hey, I want to put my whole record collection on my phone. I mean, that's some pretty radical thing. And, of course, we know he didn't develop it. He turned it over to a bunch of engineers who get no credit for it. But that person has to be thinking like that big picture. What's a bigger goal than you can ever imagine? Because the easy thing is then to say, hey, look at the money we're bringing in. We're just stacking it up, and to just get comfortable where you are. But you can always bet that there's somebody in your area who is looking out and who is going to challenge. And what happens, so many CEOs and so many companies, and like I said, so many small businesses, they live in the here and now. And then what happens, the trend has already passed them. And now they're like, oh, well, I better get on board. But it's too late at that time because customer loyalty has already shifted to these other brands or these other more convenient places that can do more things in a more efficient and effective way. And so you lose it forever. It's not like, hey, once I get on board, I'll get my customers back. No, they've established these loyalties elsewhere. And that's what Kodak found out. And that's why Kodak will never be able to recover. They're anywhere, anything close to what they were.
And I mean, it's human nature, but we don't like to change unless we have to. And in most cases, when you do change, it turns out to be a good thing. You not only learn more, but you're more profitable that way. And again, you've got to stay in front of that. Now, if you've got, and the amazing story, and I didn't know about that at Kodak, the fact that they actually had the technology and the intel in the building itself to be this even mega conglomerate, even a bigger thing than they already were, is just absolutely amazing. Talk about Blockbuster. We, growing up, we always loved Blockbuster. We always went down to our Blockbuster store. They were like Starbucks, man. There was one on every single corner you walked in. We enjoyed going through all the titles. It was almost like going to Spencer's and looking through the posters, man. I mean, that was one thing you went through, and it went through the entire store. You ended up buying more videos than you actually wanted to. You probably didn't watch half of them, but you paid for them. Talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my wife, young couple, you know, we couldn't afford to go to the movie every weekend. And so many people, you went to Blockbuster and you would fight for, and I remember sometimes there would be VHS cassettes on the wall, and sometimes they'd have 30 and you were just hoping you could get there while one of those 30 was still in there, because if a new movie came out, you were fighting for those. And so Blockbuster was, you know, had a dominant share of the market, and they had just been the leader in movie rental, and they were innovating. And of course, it was a little bit of transition from the VHS over to DVD, but they still were able to do that. They navigated that successfully. But back in 2000, the founder of Netflix, Reed Hastings, he went to the Blockbuster CEO and said, I want to propose a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And what Netflix wanted to do was they wanted Blockbuster to advertise their brand in the stores. And then Netflix would run Blockbuster online. So they're already thinking, hey, you've got the store market. We don't want to compete with you. We're not. But what we want to do is, hey, we're going to, if you remember when Netflix first started, you pay $8 a month and you'd say, hey, I want X videos. And they'd send it to you, you play them, you had to send them back in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
And so that wasn't necessarily an exciting idea. And so Blockbuster was thinking, again, just a moment, hey, why do we need them? People come down to our store all the time. Why would we need to mail them? And so, and what about this online? He said it was a niche business. And so their business model was, and the reality was, if they would have gone into partnership together, that would have actually saved Blockbuster. But because of 2010, Blockbuster filed for bankruptcy, and now Netflix is a multi-billion-dollar company and growing more and more every year. And so again, all of that was made. Now I don't know who was advising the CEO, but hey, I'm in a dominant position. Here's a guy who sees, hey, here's something more exciting, this futuristic, but they can't see anything more than, why do I need to change anything? I'm making lots of money now. And everybody knows Netflix. In another generation, nobody's going to remember Blockbuster.
That's got to be one of the worst feelings as a CEO, or maybe that person that had the opportunity to make that call, and just feel the hemorrhaging. You see, it's almost like a football game where you know, the dominance has just totally changed with the other side of the ball, and you just can't stop the bleeding. You've thrown everything you can at it. And then, of course, to make that phone call to Netflix after the fact, it's a little too late because they realize what they've already got. What about BlackBerry? BlackBerry, I didn't realize. Is BlackBerry still out there or no?
They are still there, but they have totally given up on cell phones. What I read is they're really more focused on software engineering at this point. And so I don't know all the different aspects of it. But I remember when cell phones were just coming out. And what was so interesting about BlackBerry was it actually had a keyboard, and it was kind of arched a little bit, and it really was. I mean, more people than anybody had a BlackBerry, and the encryption even that they used into the early 2000s, it was second to none. But what they were focused on, this is a little bit different aspect, a little bit different challenge sometimes. Rather just identifying a big goal, is sometimes you have to evaluate your current position. And that involves sometimes users, the people, your market, and how are they perceiving, and how can you make their experience better? You know, in the nonprofit world, we send surveys out all the time, and I'm requesting feedback from donors. I'm requesting feedback from our clients that we're actually doing the service, the donors that are supporting it, the volunteers, and all of that. I want that feedback to understand what their experience is, because I understand a volunteer who comes to work or comes and does a service here, if they have a bad experience, then they're never going to become a donor. And they're also going to be somebody who is not advocating for us out in the community. So it's more than just about, hey, I need some volunteers to get some tasks. You have to really get into understanding what their experience is, because they're going to be a mouthpiece for you, good or bad, out in the community. Lots of times based on it. So I bring that back to BlackBerry. BlackBerry had a lot dominant market share. Now, this is before iPhones came about and took everything over. But so what happened was they stopped focusing on user experience. And so here comes iPhone, here comes the others where you have touchscreen displays. And BlackBerry was just more concerned about protecting what it already had. And so it failed to adapt to the changes. And so now we can't imagine having a phone that we could not touch the screen and touch apps and all of that. But that's exactly what BlackBerry did. And so even though it had market share and the technology was really good, when other options came along, they were not prepared. And they kept trying to jam the same phone down people's throats. And people said, no, the user experience is much more enjoyable with an iPhone, things I can touch screen, shift, go app to app very quickly. And so, again, it wasn't necessarily that they didn't have a big idea about the cell phone, but they lost track of who they're marketing this to. And that's really important. And, again, I go back to it's not just one. It's everybody who uses our services or needs our services. I want to know their experience. I want to know the people who are giving dollars, because they feel like their dollars are being used in a wise way, and I want their feedback. And then again, those who volunteer. So I want every stakeholder to have some input here, but companies don't like that lots of times. They don't like a lot of people because there's a bit of an arrogance. Mm-hmm. Hey, we know what we're doing. What we're doing is obviously working. We're making a lot of money. And so they're just hesitant to step out into something. If they know what they're doing here, they don't know what, if I step in this direction, what's going to happen. So again, you come back to fear, you come back to being risk averse, and the results, as happened so many times, BlackBerry doesn't even deal with cellular phones anymore.
And it's a shame, because all of these have such a branded name, and there's a cost and association with that name. I'm going to throw you for a loop on one that was certainly never in my house, but it was certainly in a lot of different houses, because it got to be to the point where it was so mainstream, and the articles were good. But Playboy, Playboy's another one of those things where, and Playboy's still around. I bring that up because I was watching The Secrets of Playboy on A&E. I stumbled upon it, believe it or not.
Oh yeah,
it's just like the Hugh Hefner story is it's absolutely disgusting, and to hear some of these people talk about his life was like, wow. But there's this name. Everybody in the world knows that name, and right now it's worthless, and it's hard to believe that you couldn't put that name on something. You're talking about hotels, boats, mansions. They had a Playboy airline. I mean, that they were everywhere. And particularly since you're talking about something that was obviously so sexual, it was so taboo. It didn't matter, man. It carried so much weight with it, didn't it?
Yeah. And I'll give you something, because what happens is lots of companies, and this goes back to, I think I've touched on an earlier episode, the need for authenticity and transparency. So look at Amazon. I'll be the first to admit I use Amazon all the time. Why? Because it's incredibly convenient. I can find anything. I don't have to go to the store, and then somebody comes and puts it on my doorstep in 2 days and I get it. But some of the horror stories that you hear that have leaked out from their employees about having no time to go to the bathroom, telling them to urinate in bottles, and just being just almost oppressive on their workforce because of the pressure to meet this public demand. And so when that comes out, then some of the shine on Amazon and their model starts to maybe. And some people said, look, I don't really want to be associated with a company who abuses their employees. Playboy's the same way. I mean, not that you ever thought that they were, let's say, a shining star, but if you just look at it from a business model, he certainly grew that into an empire. And but what you see behind the scene is you see somebody who was a narcissistic egomaniac who was willing to abuse women, hurt them, indifferent to long-term effects of that lifestyle. And so again, eventually the curtain gets pulled back. Sometimes it's an employee, sometimes you see it right now in the news industry. So many news anchors, you see it with Chris Cuomo, so many things where they've attacked women. You know, you got the Me Too movement and all these people who get on TV and judge others, and then the screens pull back on their life, and then they're exposed. And so it's very important that what you portray to the public, whether you're a for-profit business or not-for-profit business, when somebody ultimately pulls that curtain back, you better be to the core who you're presenting yourself to the public, or you have a mess on your hands.
Yeah, unfortunately for Hugh Hefner, he left this earth before they could actually pull it back, because he was a well-protected man a lot of different ways. There were a lot of people getting cash handshakes that were associated with him. We had two more real quick, and I think this is just amazing because I'm learning a lot about some of these previous businesses, and a guy is 55 years old. I've enjoyed all these businesses, including Circuit City. I remember buying stoves from Circuit City, my refrigerators, and obviously they explored the business side of it. Talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, so I remember the very first, it's so funny, the very first computer I actually bought for myself was from Circuit City. And I remember it was an HP printer, and nothing fancy, an HP desktop. And so that just came with the monitor and the CPU. And I paid $2,000 for it back in 1998. And it's just amazing that it couldn't begin to even handle the programs that are out there today. The capacity and these things have grown so much, but Circuit City was the place to go. You know, it kind of hurt places like Radio Shack. I mean, anything that you needed digitally, you would go to Circuit City. Well, this is kind of an example where they got into a business called CarMax, and a lot of people may be familiar with that. And so what happened was, is this was where they could assemble used cars and let people almost running like, you know, huge used car lots, and really got focused on that. And that became so much of their core businesses. The story is that they begin to let a lot of their talented supervisors go. And so they were kind of stagnant over on the electronic side of it, and they kind of leaned more towards the CarMax industry. Well, here comes Best Buy. And so what ends up happening is they couldn't keep up with Best Buy, because Best Buy was the new kid on the block and had a lot of, you remember the tech teams that they had, hey, come ask us any question, we can walk you through your problems. And I remember at that time, or shortly thereafter, that's when they began to get wireless. You could, yep, do wireless in your home rather than having to wire through your walls and snake cables up from upstairs to downstairs. I mean, it was a real revolution in that sense. But what happened was Best Buy caught them off guard. And what ended up happening was, in order to compete, they actually had to let so many experienced sales staff go. Well, what ended up happening was, when customers came into Circuit City, they had so many new employees that the employees couldn't answer the tech questions. And they're like, here's a huge store, I can't find anybody to answer my question. Yet almost everybody could answer it over at Best Buy. And so market demand, they can meet a market need, and they took their eye off the goal and stepped into an area that did have risk and really didn't have a connection. And I didn't get into, you know, the full history of why they made that shift. And some people may say, well, Michael, you say take risk and be willing to take risk. Well, they took a risk and that backfired on them. And, you know, my response to that is, we see this in the nonprofit world. It goes back to when we were talking about mission creep.
Yeah.
So if I have a vision for, and I'm a Circuit City where I'm selling all things computer, all things digital. To then step into the car business, you would like, wait a minute, that's not really within our, that's a department that really doesn't fit into what we're doing. Rather than saying, oh, okay, well, we're going to get into digital wash machines, or we're going to get into digital. So they stepped outside of what their mission statement is, which nonprofits do very often. Oh, here's a need. Well, I'm going to sneak out here and do this. And before too long, if you don't have somebody guiding that ship, you lose the core of what you were there to do. And this is a perfect example. Circuit City could no longer do what it once did very well, but Best Buy could. And that's why you see Best Buys everywhere and Circuit City file for bankruptcy.
Why not just create a new mission statement? I mean, if you're going to do something totally different, if I'm a radio station, all of a sudden I want to get into clothing that's unassociated with my radio station, why wouldn't I just create a new business?
Well, you could. You could create a new business and create a new mission statement. You could even have that attached under the umbrella, and I'm sure it was probably like that. But from what I've read, I think where Circuit City really went off was they started making a lot of money. It was very successful initially, the CarMax and selling used cars. And I think they just shifted their focus on, hey, here's where our money, here's where our bread's going to be buttered moving forward. And so they did not maintain the very talented supervisors that they had. And then they had to lay off talented employees. And so they did one successfully, but they did not maintain a real vision and pay due diligence to their core business, and it came back to get them.
All right, we got one more, and this has been remarkable. I'd love it. We could just pick through all these businesses week to week, yeah. And I think the stories are great, and you've done your homework on it. But Tower Records, obviously, I just went to their website, towerrecords.com. They're selling vinyl like it's 1970, like it's 1972, man. Vinyl is back, and I can't believe it because I went to 5th and Charles the other day, and they're selling albums for $16.99. My radio partner here tried to get Journey's Infinity album, and it was like $50 if you want to go back and buy this stuff. Of course, they're not printing any new Infinity albums, so that's why they're so expensive. But talk about Tower Records, and I will give them credit. If you're going to own it, you need to own it. And if the word records is in your business, that's what you do. But it wasn't like that was incremental. I used to spin 45s. I was right on the cusp of 78s at one point and 33 and a third. So I was all about it. I remember getting the first CD. We couldn't play cassette tapes on radio because you couldn't cue them up. And we went from 8-tracks. That was very incremental. It didn't happen overnight. How did Tower Records not see that coming?
Yeah, well. Well, you know, they were I found out, and I didn't even know this myself, just off the top of my head, but I researched it and found out that they were the first retail music chain to create the concept of retail music stores. And so you could go there and get CDs and DVDs and electronic gadgets and video games and everything that went with that. So they were very successful, but what they could not anticipate, and so I don't want to hit Tower Records too hard on this, but the reason I include it in this list is because sometimes things happen in the market forces that you cannot anticipate. So a good example recently would just be COVID. We had to shut down our boutique business that relied on beach traffic going down to Florida and Alabama. It was right there on the interstate because COVID shut down all traffic for a year and a half. Our customer base totally. Now, how we had prepared for something like that was we had already been digital. Mm-hmm. And so when I say digital, online, had an online presence. And so that helped for us from closing down the business altogether. Well, what happened to Tower Records where you begin to get these a lot of music piracy and streaming services when digital was coming about. So you had, I'm sure you'll remember Napster. Mm-hmm. It was a peer-to-peer file sharing internet service, spread like a virus. It was launched in 1999. And so from when you begin to see, then you had illegal services such as LimeWire and BitTorrent and others that they found it was easy to get music for free. So people were saying, well, why go buy it? I can download this into my phone. I can download this or connect with this and play it all the time. And so that digital revolution hit them in large part because some of that, like I said, was even illegal. Tower Records, however, and I couldn't really find any really solid information on this, but the sales plunged from, I mean, they dominated the industry, and they had to file for bankruptcy in 2004. So they went from dominating it, and but within 5 years, the internet digital presence had basically brought it to its knees. And so the lesson of that is Tower Records may have said, hey, I see, how do we create a digital presence? And you see this now. We have this in Amazon Music and Apple Music. Everybody's got their own music where they've licensed it and they pay the artist and it's a subscription.
Yeah, I'm here to tell you, I know all about that.
Yeah. Well, Tower Records, for whatever reason, did not see that, or if they saw it as a possibility, they did not have the means to move forward. So the perception that I got was Tower Records says, hey, we've got CDs, we got, this is the model. All of a sudden, here comes these sometimes illegal people online that are streaming this music. We have to fight to shut them down. And so they've got on the defensive fighting Napster and LimeWire and BitTorrent, rather than saying, okay, this is illegal, this is wrong, we can fight this, but people are responding to this. How do we set up a system in which to do that? So that could have propelled them into being a leader in the digital market.
Yeah.
But instead, they were fighting a losing battle, because once people could understand they could get music online, the game was over.
Well, the horses were out of the barn.
Long
lost of the days of you getting the new Genesis album, let me come over and record it on my cassette day. And I was in radio long enough that, you know, we had the deals with record labels where we would want to do a CD sideshow or an album side most of the time, because the jocks wanted to go outside and smoke cigarettes or go meet their girlfriends behind the alley to have 15 or 20 minutes of straight music. And we'd have to put some type of identifier or something in between the cuts, because the record labels were afraid that our listeners were going to record those half an hours and they weren't going to go out and buy the records. Little did we know it was going to turn into a much bigger problem. Michael, out of time, man. I love this, man. This was fantastic. And it's all part of the tactical and strategic planning. We can continue it next week on Mission Minded. Again, go to Mission Minded on Spotify, or you can search Tony Curry Radio and listen to all the previous episodes. And of course, you can hear it live right here on Tony Curry Radio. We do it every Wednesday at noon and 7 o'clock. Thank you, brother. I appreciate you. I look forward to talking to you next week.
Enjoyed it very much.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.